Okay, so we are going to be starting today officially. Last week, I kind of, the ones who were here got kind of a dry run of the kickoff of this next study that we're going to be embarking on. There's been a couple of additions since then, but today we're going to kind of introduce this new study and where we're going. And start thinking about how we're going to approach this. We're going to be looking at the book of Revelation for the next, I don't know how long. Like, I wish that I had an idea of how long this would take. Even in just reading through this thing, like me sitting down in my mind, going through it in a single shot takes an hour, right? So, like, this is a, and that's not digging into anything. That's literally just letting the words hit my eyeballs and my brain, right? This is a massive undertaking. And it's one that I have been bouncing around for a hot minute. The study on heaven has had me in this book more and more and more. And it's been personally revealing to me my own shortcomings and understanding of this book, and kind of had me in a place where I'm like, there's no better time than now. And at the same time, this book is one that, for obvious reasons, terrifies me to present in any public like setting, like a classroom setting like we're in this morning. So I do ask for your continued prayer in this. We're going to kind of lay out today, just like I said, introducing the book itself, introducing some things to think about when we're thinking about this book. One thing that I would ask, I never like whenever I'm teaching something to say, you guys need to be doing this alongside me, because I feel like the Lord's leading you in your own study time to study the things that He has for you. And as a teacher, I'm cool with like me doing my study and preparation and presenting something when we get together. This is one of those books, however, that I feel if you want to most effectively get from it greater understanding, there's likely going to be a need that you do some type of take-home reading throughout the week, to kind of just get in a mindset. Like, I'm 2 weeks in now to kind of trying to prepare this, and that's not sufficient time at all. So I'm going to be, in some ways, teaching and trying to, like in my own preparation, get ahead of where we're going so that I can better kind of direct what's coming down the line. Not an easy task when it comes to something like this. So I ask that you would be patient with me in my preparing and in my presenting from week to week the material that we're kind of digging into. I hope that you understand that I'm trying to kind of get my feet under me with this. This is going to be, I pray, an excellent companion to the study that we're doing on Wednesday nights with heaven. Also, it should, when we get into different questions and areas in that study where we're looking specifically in the book of Revelation, it should give us a good foundation to stand on to have spent some time in the book outside of those singular questions. So that's another thing that I'm hoping to kind of draw out from this as well. So we're going to be in Revelation. If you want to go ahead and turn there, we'll be in Revelation 1:1 when we get to reading. That will probably be towards the end of the class today, because I want to give a little bit of background and just things to think about along the way as we're studying this book. So starting with the author of the book, this is clear if you read it at any length that the author is put forward as John. This is the author of the Gospel of John. This book was written while in exile on the island of Patmos. And most would date the writing of the book to 94, to somewhere between 94 AD and 96 AD. So somewhere in the 90s AD, John being exiled here, and during this exile, having this prophetic vision that he takes down here in the book of Revelation. Now, while the majority of people currently that you would look to for dating this book would say that this book falls between 94 to 96 AD, and at some point in this study, we'll look at the specifics of why the those dates would be selected there. That's not the only dates that are put forward for the time that this book could have potentially have been written. Another time frame that's oftentimes put forward here is in the 50s to 60s AD. So sometime between 54 and 68 AD is another time that's often put forward for the dating of this book. As we get into some specifics, and this is going to be weeks off for us now, but I want to go ahead and put it out there. We're going to talk about some of these interpretive approaches that are taken with the book of Revelation here in a moment. And some of them kind of rely heavily on the dating of this book to be the early dating. And like I say, in time, we'll get into the specifics of why that is. Some supporting evidence for John's authorship of the book. Outside of the fact that the book, if you read it, says a number of places it attributes this to John himself. So other evidence that can be seen for this is if we were to compare the writing of the Gospel of John with the writing of Revelation and look for similarities that we find between them. And there are some interesting and unique similarities that come out between the writing of the book of Revelation and the writing of John. Both the Gospel of John and Revelation refer to Jesus as the Word, and this is something that's specific to John and the book of Revelation. Revelation chapter 19, verse 13, and John 1:1 would be where you could go to see those references being put together there. Also, both the Gospel of John and Revelation uniquely call Jesus the Lamb, which is seen in Revelation chapter 5, verses 6 and verse 8, as well as John chapter 1, verse 29. So these are just kind of some details that you can see when you examine the writing of one versus the other. There's also ample evidence from the early church fathers to the authorship being John here, the author of the Gospel of John. A couple of things that I want us to think about, and so I'm putting these out here now. These are things that, and I've kind of debated whether or not we touch on this now or whether we just hold off and hit it later. And for the sake of it being something that you're aware of early on in this study, I've decided to kind of put this in the introductory kind of kickoff this morning. I want us to think about the interpretive approaches that have been taken when considering how to read and how to understand the book of Revelation. A couple of things that are kind of unique before we get into that. A couple of things that are kind of interesting or noteworthy things to consider here is that the book of Revelation is the only book in the New Testament that the entire purpose of it is it is a prophetic book. There are a number of prophetic Old Testament books. Revelation stands unique. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't prophecies or prophetic statements throughout other New Testament books, but as the sole purpose of this book is a book of prophecy, which when we get into the interpretive views here, we'll kind of think about like prophecy, the fact that this book is prophetic in like everything that it's trying to put forward here. It causes us to have to consider how it is that we are to interpret things that are said throughout this book. So another thing to thing to consider here, and I think that Dr. J. Vernon McGee has a quote that I'll use here, because I think he does a pretty solid job of encapsulating the idea that I want us to think about here. So, John the writer, and this is a quote from him here. John the writer reaches farther back into eternity past than any other writer in Scripture, and we see this in John chapter 1 verses 1 through 3. He also says he reaches farther into eternity future in the book of Revelation. And we've been exploring that some, as we've been exploring on Wednesday nights, heaven, and using the latter chapters of the book of Revelation kind of as a starting point for those discussions when we think about heaven eternal there as well. So we're going to be diving into this book that is prophetic in nature. One of the things that we have to be aware of and caution ourselves on when we do this, and this will not be the last time that I say this. This is the source of, when I consider teaching this book, the source, the thing that makes me most nervous, most uncomfortable about it, is knowing myself and knowing how easy it is to fall into those places that I imagine the Jewish leaders of Jesus' day found themselves in unknowingly. This place where you have the truth before you in these prophetic books, and for the sake of something in you, not in them, but in you, you miss Jesus himself for your own thing, right? That thing that's in you that can't cause you to fathom that these words would be pointing to this person. And that type of like reality that the people that knew the book the most then failed in, like, you got one job and you failed in it miserably for your people. That's a fear that I have when I approach the New Testament's prophetic book. Now, when I say that, and you'll probably hear me say again a number of times how terrifying it is, the book itself is not a terrifying book. I want to put that out there, and I mentioned that last week. I'll mention that throughout, because there's going to be the terror from my end of having to present it to you, which is not the terror that is drawn from the book itself, but the realization that I could get it wrong, and I need to be careful that I don't, right? The book itself is a very comforting book if you are a believer. Like, there are some themes that run throughout this book, if you're a believer, that you should be spending time in it, right? We should probably be very careful that we spend sufficient time in it. If you're ever going to say, this says this, especially in front of people, it's one thing to build your own opinion of what a thing says. It's a whole other thing to present it to others and say, thus saith the Lord. We should be very careful in our preparation that we prepare sufficiently for presenting it. But as you approach it as a reader, as a believer, you should be comforted by what it says, because what it demonstrates to us, there's a couple of themes that we're going to see throughout this book. I'm going to list for you three of the major themes here. One, this book demonstrates clearly the sovereignty of God throughout each and every one of the pages that we will read. Each and every verse that we read proclaims that God is in control of absolutely everything, right? He is in control of everything. Another major theme that runs through this book is that Christ, he is victorious and he is exalted, right? Like, this is a theme that we will not miss. And our first couple of passes through the book, say our first couple, I don't know how many we're going to do ultimately, but the first pass, bare minimum, is going to be simply reading through this book, looking for these major themes, looking at the sovereignty of God throughout the pages of this book, looking at Christ's victory and exaltation throughout the pages of this book, and also another major theme that we see within the book of Revelation is that God's justice and judgment is put forth in this book. And I think a lot of times one of the reasons that it can be terrifying is that we see this side of God that, like, is frightening, right? It's frightening. I'll say it's frightening if you are against him. If you're with him, if he's called you to himself, this is like hopeful. This is hopeful, especially when you stand in the face of persecution and those who would do harm to you because of who you are and who you stand with, is that ultimately God is the judge and he is just, and that we see this demonstrated in this book clearly. God is victorious here. So with those things in mind, a couple of things that we're going to look at, and this will probably not come out in the first several times that we're together. You don't necessarily have to be thinking about these things when we start out today or next week or even the week after that. But at some point, we're going to get into this probably after we step past chapter 4 of the book of Revelation. We're going to start getting into areas where these interpretive approaches are going to be something that we need to be considering. And my approach to this is we're going to give equal thought towards the views that have been held throughout church history. So I'm going to give you four interpretive approaches that have been used here. The first one, you may or may not have ever heard of this word at all. So I may say it a couple of times. There's the preterist view. Now, what is the preterist view? Preterists believe that most, if not all, of the events in Revelation were fulfilled in the first century AD, particularly with the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. This view interprets the prophecies of Revelation as being directly related to the early Christians and the challenges they faced under Roman persecution. Preterists see the book as a message of hope to these early Christians, assuring them that God would triumph over their oppressors. Now, I mentioned the dating of the book. Some most even likely hold that this book is dated between 94 to 96 AD is the time that it was authored. If you read, or if you were listening there as I was reading through some of the details about the preterist view, you would realize the reason that that view would have a hard time with the dating of the book being 94 to 96, because they would hold that much of what's written in the book of Revelation was fulfilled at, during, before the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. So if Jerusalem fell in 70 AD and the book wasn't written until the 90s, that's sometime later. So that would make that view particularly difficult to hold there. When it makes sense for us to get into it, we'll look at the dating of why they would hold to a view that was 54 to 68 AD as far as the time of authorship of this book. So the preterist view, again, kind of how do I understand this view or reading of it, is that simply they would think that most of this has already taken place and that it was pointed to events that occurred up to and leading to the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. That's the preterist view. The historist view approaches and interprets the book of Revelation as a broad overview of the entire course of church history. So there's this view that interprets this as something that has been playing out from the time of the early church up until now and into the future. So this is something under the historicist view, that they would see this is something that has been playing out through church history and continues to be played out. So this view would tend to look at things that are said within the prophecies and would look to attempt to align those things with historic events that seem pertinent to what's being said there, right? So the historicist view, I feel like I'm murdering that today. They would typically look at this as something that's being played out over the course of history. And then there is the futurist view, which sees, so they believe that most of the events described within the book of Revelation are yet to occur, right? That this is something off into the future, that none of this or most of this has not occurred to date, and that this is something that is going to occur in the future. This view holds that starting from Revelation 4 onward, the text describes events that will happen at the end of time, including the tribulation, the second coming of Christ, the millennium, and the final judgment. This perspective is popular among many evangelical and fundamentalist Christians who see current events as signs that the prophecies of Revelation might soon be fulfilled. So that last statement there, kind of pointing towards, I would probably say that many, if not most, like present company included, you probably fall into the futures view. If you've never dug into this specifically and thought, how do I interpret this? You've probably, we live in a culture that that the default inherited understanding is that futurist view, right? So when you read the book of Revelation, if you've not put any thought into other potential perspectives, the likelihood is that you've been taught a futurist view. You think with that lens already. So this is going to be one of those things that as we go through, you will have a tendency to fall into this group. That's okay. These are all of these are valid approaches to interpret this. All of them have good points that are made throughout. There's a fourth view here as well, which is an idealist view. So the idealist view approaches and interprets Revelation as a symbolic representation of the ongoing struggle between good and evil, rather than a series of events tied to specific historical or future occurrences, right? So like they would look at this as something that could be applied. You could apply it to every generation from the time of the early church to now, and have things that are going to be brought out and are going to be important there. So that's a lot. I'm going to list those four views again, and those are, so there's two different places where we're going to run into this. Like, people have different opinions here, right? So there's these interpretive challenges of the majority of the book. So from chapter 4 on to the end of Revelation, which we get these four views here, those that I'm trying to think of ways that I can classify these just in like everyday language. So you've got the ones that think most of it's already happened and happened before the fall. The fall of Jerusalem. That's the predator's view. You've got those that think that this has been playing out over the course of church history. That's those who would hold to the historicist view. And then you've got those that think all of this that we're reading in the book of Revelation is something that's coming in the future. Which probably many, if not most of you, probably are in that, or have been like taught and brought up in that type of view. So that's probably going to be the one that you're most comfortable or familiar with. And then you have the idealist view that doesn't necessarily look for this to play out real time in history or having played out, but that it's more symbolic in the way that we should interpret it. And as we go through those verses in the coming weeks, we're going to be looking at these views throughout to kind of get an understanding of how these things could be interpreted. One thing that I'm going to attempt not to do throughout this study is tell you must think this way, right? And there's a part of that is because like real talk, I'm trying to figure out where I land still. Because I know where I've come from as far as thoughts in the past. I know things that I'm like, no, I don't agree with this. But there's many of these views that I'm like, I see what you're saying. Like, that makes sense to me, right? I don't think that any of these are heretical. That's what I'll say. I think that if you were to take these interpretive lenses and apply it throughout and be consistent, I think that you would find yourself in the company of many blood-bought, Jesus-loving believers from the time of the early church to today, right? So that, keep that in mind. Like, there's not, like, I'm not hoping one of these wins out over the other. Now, I may at some point along this shift my opinion, and I reserve the right to change my mind on any of these things along the way, right? So now we're going to get into another place where we're going to hit some interpretive challenges in this book, and I want us to be prepared for it. It's a long way off. So if these are, if the ones that we're looking at are starting in chapter 4, this next one doesn't start till basically like we're at the home stretch, and y'all have forgot that I even said this years ago, right? Like, that's where we're going to be at when we get to this point. So the next thing that's going to be an interesting interpretive challenge is when we get to this talk about the millennium, this thousand-year reign of Christ. And here we find three major categories. You will find me very opinionated about one of them. It's a subcategory that I'm very opinionated about. I may mention it today as we're looking at it. That way, you know, some of my pet peeves here. You're probably not going to be surprised. So, again, with these as well, what I will say is, if you fall into any of these, even the one that, like, it's going to catch shade from me this whole time, and you'll know it when we get there, even if you held that one, like, I don't think that you're heretical for holding that. Like, John MacArthur holds that opinion, and it's like, I'll throw shade at him for holding that opinion because I don't think that it aligns with I don't think that it aligns with his general approach to interpreting Scripture, but he holds it, and this guy knows the Bible better than me. Y'all all know his name, right? If y'all weren't sitting in this class this morning and someone was like, Landon Key thinks this opinion, you'd be like, who? Who? Okay, so if you do hold that wrong opinion, then at least you're in good company. The shade throwing is already there. So you'll know. I'll go ahead and point it out because it is one that I'm like, But if you hold it, that's all good. We can still be friends. This is not like you go and serve at another church type of difference here, right? So the three major, and then we'll get into the subcategories of the first. So the first view on the millennium is premillennialism. So premillennialists believe that Jesus will return before the millennium to establish a literal thousand-year reign on earth. According to this view, Christ's second coming will precede the final judgment and establishment of a new heaven and a new earth. This perspective often includes a period of tribulation before Christ's return, and then we'll come back to the subcategories of this view. So the second major view here is amillennialism. So amillennialists interpret the millennium symbolically rather than literally. So they would not necessarily say that there is going to be a literal thousand-year reign of Christ on earth, but this is something that is symbolic and represents what's going on in heaven even now. Third major view is postmillennialism. Lord Jesus, one of the terrors of having to do this is having to stand in front of people and read these long words. Help me, Lord Jesus. Postmillennialists believe that Christ will return after the millennium, which is viewed as an era of peace and righteousness that will be established through the spread of the Christian church. This view suggests that the world will gradually improve through the influence of the gospel, eventually leading to a thousand-year period, either literally or figuratively, of peace and Christian dominance. After this period, Christ will return and the final judgment will take place and the eternal state will be ushered in. All right, so the three major views when we get there, we've got the premillennialists, we've got the amillennialists, and we've got the postmillennialists, right? So that all depends on, like, what the view is of when the millennium reign takes place. Premillennialism can be subdivided into two major views, and one of them is the one that I will tend to throw shade at. The historic premillennialist view is just that. It's the view of this premillennialist view that's essentially dates back really early in church history. And then the subdivision that comes after that, which is where, like, MacArthur would fall, is the dispensational premillennialism, or he would be a dispensational premillennialist. And this adds a framework of biblical dispensations that usually involves a rapture of the church before a period of tribulation, followed by Christ's return and his millennial reign. I'm not going to get into why I tend to throw shade at that. I would also say that that's where I came from as far as my original understanding of this book. And the reason that I came from there is because it was the view that I inherited. It was the view that, like, everybody, I didn't know there was other ways of thinking about it, because it was only ever taught that particular way. And it wasn't until many years later, spending time in the book myself and also coming to the realization that that view originated real late in church history, like real late, like in the last couple hundred years, which means that most of the church through the history of the church has not held that view. It's not been a view that's been known to them. It was a view that came up after the dispensational movement kind of took hold. It's also a view that's mostly prevalent in the Western world. We'll get into that more as we get to the millennium. That's way off in the future, way off in the future as far as the study is concerned, because that's, 20 chapters deep. And that's going to be a long time from now. That's going to be a long time. So we're right here at the edge. Three kind of big categories of the way we're going to outline this book, and the way we'll kind of spend our time. When we get back together next time, we'll kick off in kind of this things that he's seen in the first chapter, the laying out, the prologue of this book, what we should be expecting to see. This, we're looking at chapter one here. That's that first major section. I'm just going to call this the intro to the book of Revelation. It doesn't necessarily have to be its own standalone section here. The next section, we're going to classify this as the things which are. This is where we're going to look at the letters to the churches in chapter 2, verse 1 through chapter 3, verse 22. So this is the second section. The first two sections are the first three chapters of the book, and then we get into the final section, which is this prophecy of the things which will take place after these things, right? So those are the three kind of major sections. It's introduction, letters to the churches, and then the prophecy that we're going to be looking at for the next several chapters. I'll save kicking off Revelation 1 through 3 until next time. Here's what I'll say. Blessed is the one, verse 3 of this, blessed is the one who reads aloud the word of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear and who keep what is written in it, for the time is near. We've been going through the Beatitudes on Sunday mornings, from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. We find in the book of Revelation a beatitude. Blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear and who keep what is written in it, for the time is near. We'll get more into that next week. I think that that is, as I've been preparing, as I've been thinking about where we're going to go on Sunday mornings, that has been the thing that's pulled me in from that, like, Landon, this is going to be terrifying to think about, to if you let that fear keep you from it, then you're going to miss out. We are going to miss out on this blessing that it puts forward for those who read this book aloud and who hear this book's words and who keep what is written in this book. And I don't want us to miss that blessing for the sake of it being difficult. So we're going to press into this difficult book, and I ask that you pray for me as we do that. And I'm going to be praying for you guys as we do that. And I hope that we can do it in as lighthearted a way as possible. Like, really, if you fall into the Disby camp, I love you, but you're going to catch shade from me in love.